Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now to my Talking Volumes conversation with actor and writer Sally Field. Field told me on the stage of The Fitz that among all of her accomplishments as a screen and theater actor, finishing this memoir was deeply fulfilling. It was 7 years in the writing, and she had to come to terms with being open about parts of her life she'd barely acknowledged to herself. Here's Sally Field.
I am really revealing things that I barely talked about myself, or, you know, certainly things that I, you know, my story, that only now was I willing to find. So completely undiscovered, yes, to myself as well. But it had not to do, ultimately, as far as the book is concerned, it had not to do with my career at all. It had to do with my own life, who I am.
Did you feel like in the career, though, that as you waited for these meteor roles, roles that tested you, that a lot of Hollywood and the industry did not realize what you were capable of doing?
Well, of course they didn't. I mean, that's, I mean, I didn't, I wasn't sure what I was capable of doing. I was working like crazy to be better, to be a better actor. I started when I was 17, and I started in the 60s in situation comedy television. And in those days, situation comedy television wasn't, you couldn't transfer from one to the other. Today is a different world. Men came out of television in those days, like James Garner and Steve McQueen and Clint Eastwood, but they were in hour-long shows, and they were, oh yes, men. So, and women were usually in the situation comedy shows that were very popular, and no one could make that transition, really. It was incredibly difficult. We were like the day laborers as opposed to the real artists. And so by the time I had done, I was 25 then and had done three television series, it wasn't that I couldn't, well, not only I couldn't pass the audition, but I couldn't get in for an audition. I couldn't get on the list. I couldn't get in the room. Matter of fact, I was sure they had a list at the gate that said, if Sally Field comes by, tell her to please go home.
So what comes through in the memoir to me is you were always hungry for deeper roles. You were willing to fight and scrap pretty hard to get them. And it took years and years for the industry to recognize that.
Well, when I felt terribly stuck, and it was also linked to what I was dealing with in my own life, my own childhood survival mechanism, kind of linked together with what was happening to me in the business, which it always had. Somehow, it was like a tapestry sort of woven together. And I was emerging out of this, you know, cocoon I had lived in kind of a fog to protect myself from traumatic things in my childhood. And I wanted to be an actor because it was where I felt most alive. And it was the only place that I felt exquisitely alive, that I could be whatever I was. I could be mean and ugly and rude and sexual and loud and everything that the little girl that was raised in the 50s was not allowed to be. Or not even that, just everything that I was. So I said to myself, all the time that I was intensely studying with Lee Strasberg at the Actors Studio and then other teachers, a wonderful teacher named David Craig at the same time, I said to myself that I could never say it was them, the big bad them out there, that it was the industry didn't know what I was. They weren't giving me a chance. The directors, that person was a fool to not know what I was. I could never blame it on them. If I wasn't where I wanted to be, it had to be because I wasn't good enough. Because only then did it still rest in my own backyard. Mm-hmm. That I still had some power to get where I wanted to be. I just had to get better. I had to maybe be so much better than anybody else who even came near the room. But all right, then that's what I had to be. Otherwise, you're powerless, and all you do is you fall into a deep depression and eat chocolate cake all day long. Because I did that too.
There's that experience when you're studying with Lee Strasberg and you decide to do a scene. I think it's a Jean-Paul Sartre scene.
I did the respectful prostitute while I was doing The Flying Nun. That kind of makes sense to me.
And it sounds like that's one of those experiences where you have that moment of feeling like all the disparate parts of you have come together. Why?
It is what I found when I was 12 years old and stepped on a stage for the first time, and it wasn't even a stage. It was a classroom with all the chairs pushed aside. I was in the seventh grade. I was 12. I did my first scene, which was from Born Yesterday. I couldn't have been a worse choice for the role. You know, it was like Heidi, the little goat girl, playing the role, you know. The brassy, sexy bombshell, you know. But when I was there, that moment of, okay, your scene is up, here you are, you're doing your scene, something happened. A bell rang. The fog cleared. I could hear myself. I've always said that I spent the rest of my life chasing the fireflies on the edges of my eyes because that's what it felt like. Like I was here, alive. I could hear my heart. I could feel my hands. And every place else I was, I felt rather numbed because of how I had lived my life to survive. So I knew I had to find a way to get to that feeling more often. It comes and goes. It's fleeting. It's this tiny little moment of feeling exquisitely alive, and then it's gone. And then you don't know what to do with your hands, and you're sort of thinking, what's the next line? From then on, I was driven to find a way to get to that feeling more often, to understand what that feeling was, to understand a craft so that I could hone it and sometimes just land in that moment. I guess athletes call it the zone, but I think it's even better than that. I'm going to argue with them and say it's everything's brighter. Your body is moving all on its own. You're not telling it what to do. And that was what I needed to do. I needed to find that constantly in my life. So eventually I got to a place, which was with Lee Strasberg, where I could study and learn how to do this. And it was the first scene. I was so naive about everything. It was the first scene that I was to perform in front of Lee. And I had chosen the respectful prostitute. And he'd given this edict to everybody because all of the actors wanted to work for Lee when he came in for 6 months out of the year to Los Angeles. And the other 6 months he would live in New York. So this edict was that he would stop every scene after 15 minutes, no matter how long it was. Because he needed to give more people a chance to perform. And I did my scene, and it went on and on, and it was like no time at all, just a flash of a second. But something happened to me in that moment. That scene, because it was an audience like this, it was an audience, and it was dark, and it was familiar, it was unfamiliar, but somehow I knew it. And could feel it like this. And Lee was there. And I just launched to do the scene. I had no craft. I didn't know how to arrive anywhere. But because I'd been a little girl that had fragmented herself in childhood, that I didn't own all the pieces of myself, I couldn't call them together. They would sometimes take over me, and I would be there and remember, but I could never really have a conversation with them. They never came together as one whole thing. And this day they did, because I called on them as an actor. I needed my sexuality in the scene, and it landed. I needed my anger in the scene, and it landed. I needed the part of me that stayed rock solid, that memorized the dialogue and never forgot it, and that came with me. I needed my sadness, the really sad part of myself, and that landed. And so I was furious and crying and said the dialogue within this deeply sexual part of myself. And that had just never happened before in my life. I felt it. But then the scene was over. And I was like, oh, my God, I just did a scene. Oh, God. Oh, dear. Here I am. And you're supposed to sit down on the stage. And then you're supposed to say to Mr. Strasberg, well, this was what I was working on. And you list the things. I was working on the posture. I was working on the dialect. I was working on the history or something. It's never supposed to be a finished product. And as my partner was talking, I remember thinking, oh, God, I wasn't working on anything. What will I say? What will I say? I won't know what to say. And so I sat on the floor like there, and Mr. Strasberg was right there. And he turned to me, and like he did everybody, I'd heard him do it, say, what were you working on? But he didn't say that. Lee said to me, why are you here? And I thought, oh, God, he's going to tell me to go. I don't belong. I shouldn't be here. Who let me in? And I said, well, I want to learn. He said, but you work all the time. I said, I know, I'm working. He said, you're in a show right now, a popular show, and you work all the time. A lot of people here, they don't work all the time. And I go, well, I know, but I it's not good enough for me. I want to be better. I want to learn what this is. And he and Lee took a breath. And meanwhile, my heart literally had stopped beating as he said this. I thought at any moment he's going to say, could someone please show her the door? And Lee kind of clicked the back of his throat. And this was at the end of it was the hiatus between year one and year two of The Flying Nun. Lee clicked the back of his throat and he said, I let this scene go on. It went on for 45 minutes.
Wow.
I went, oh, I'm sorry. He said, because I wanted to watch you. I went, oh, God. And he said, very softly, you were quite brilliant. And he said it so softly, I thought, he didn't really say that. He didn't really say that. And he clicked his throat again, like he had a popcorn kernel stuck on it. And he said, quite brilliant. And it began to change my life. Because even though I had to go back and do the next year of The Flying Nun and the next, I heard his words. And I soon after began to work with him intensely in trying to learn this craft that has been the lifeline to myself for my whole life.
Did you learn how to call on those techniques to pull all those parts of your... I mean, did it become easier to find that mm-hmm. when the role demanded it?
I think I talk about this a lot in the book. As I began to work with Lee, and he was teaching acting exercises, but to me, they were exercises to pull my fragmented self together. Mm-hmm. And then again, like serendipitously, I mean, that life would happen as it does, that the roles, they didn't necessarily come to me. I had to fight like hell for them. I had to lay my body on the line for them, sometimes literally. Anyway. But in playing these roles, because I had learned a craft, And I could go into myself and sort myself out and say, I want this part of me to do this, and I want this part of me to come here. It meant I learned to call on them, to have conversations with each other. And in roles that I needed them, they informed me because they were me. But when I was off stage, I didn't have access to them. But as I got more adept in using them, in later on, in Norma Rae, they became more familiar to me and were more my friends and not just some stranger that came in my body all of a sudden, like, yikes, who is this? It was an odd way to heal, but certainly it worked, I guess.
Why do you think it was difficult to call on that for your personal life, for the experiences that you were going through and wishing that you were responding differently?
Well, because my childhood had trauma in it, because my stepfather was difficult, to say the least, and I was with him. He was my father, essentially, even though I had a real father that I would see frequently. But my real father was non-existent. He would demand that I come over and spend time with him. But the minute I was there, I think he didn't know what to, when I was very little, he didn't know what to do with me. I think he thought I was another species. Along with my brother, we were like little kittens. And that you give them a little food and a litter box and make sure they have water and maybe a little ball to roll around. And then you kind of go do your thing. And I never had a conversation with him. He never took me to have a cheeseburger or go to the movies or go to the park or play ball. Nothing. And I would, if I wanted to sit on the couch with him and listen to the ball game, that would be fine. I would have rather eaten dirt. So there was that side. Then my stepfather was big and loud and colorful and very physical and tactile and always held me and touched me. And he was a very confusing figure. Both loved him tremendously, was terrified of him. And the difficulties in our relationship that grew and grew and grew were so hard for a little child to deal with. The complications of having so many emotions going on, both terror and love and surely anger. I remember it so distinctly, having the times that I was with my stepfather as the sexuality between us grew, even though I didn't know what it was. I was 8 and 9 and 10 and 11. But something in me was so deeply uncomfortable. I call it fingernails on the insides of me, and it would begin to scrape on me. Like I didn't have the ability to verbalize the emotion, but it was signaling me in a physicality. Mm-hmm. It was a physical feeling. And my head, I wanted to please him. I wanted him to love me. I needed to be loved by him. And so I would disappear out the window. The rock-solid piece of me stayed, the piece of me that knows how to learn some dialogue and say it no matter what. That part of me stayed and could perform all the tasks and didn't feel terrified and didn't feel angry and didn't want to leave the room and didn't want to burst into tears. But all of those other pieces were outside with the sycamore tree that I could see through the window, and I could hear the leaves rustling, and they sounded like water. They sounded like a stream, like rustling water. So that was my survival system. And when I found acting at 12, I heard myself. It came together for a minute, and then it was gone. And then for the rest of my life, I sought to pull myself back together because it was acting that did it. And you can be lonely in your life. You can be lonely alone. You can be alone. And there you are. That feels sort of lonely. But loneliness, the real loneliness in life, is when you don't have contact with yourself, when you aren't there inside. And I was so profoundly lonely, and I could feel my pieces come back together periodically, and then I wasn't.
You observed yourself sometimes, right? When you felt split apart from who you were.
Yeah, I would sometimes, when it was terribly traumatic, I would be almost have the feeling of watching from someplace else. But I also would have that feeling sometimes performing. Mm-hmm. Like I was not, it was a very similar configuration. And so that's what I mean, that I went into this craft in a way because it completely blended with a system that I had created mm-hmm. for myself. And in learning to hone and own that craft, it slowly gave me the tools to own myself.
I'm Carrie Miller. Now back to this Talking Volumes conversation I had with actress Sally Field last week on the stage of the Fitzgerald Theater. I asked her about something that she has said about acting and how playing a complex character changed her, transformed her as a person. Here's what she said.
You actually, you know, the chemicals in your brain actually respond to it as if it's a real experience.
Right.
You know, if you're playing a character going down on the Titanic, part of you is actually going down on the Titanic. And you have, you know, the same chemicals are going on in your body. You know, the same fight or flight, the same, your things are really happening as if they're really happening. And especially with the kind of work that I learned to do, and probably I do even when I don't even need to do it.
So, like, meaning
really,
what?
Do you need to do that field? Couldn't you just do less of that? And like,
do you mean in roles?
Yeah,
some roles.
You know,
that you...
do you really have to torture yourself quite that much? I mean, you could do quite a lot less and be fine, but not me. I'm like, you know, just gone to, you know, such a deep degree of exposure of myself and something going on inside of me. And then you apply it to the character using, you know, hopefully a lot of discipline that fits within what that character is going through. But it is my own experience.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about a role that you think, did I have to pull it all in for that? I really didn't have to. But that you do it anyway, because that's what you know to do. That you do too much.
I always worry about that. I was hoping you'd say, no, you don't. Not ever. I've never seen that happen.
I know you know best. So is there a role that...
I was hoping not. But I'm sure if I thought about it, I would think that there were plenty of places that I did that. But I can't think of them right off the top of my head unless it's like Beyond the Titanic. No, that wasn't that. That would be what was Beyond the Poseidon I did. But I don't think I ever cried in that because I just wanted off the whole thing. So I cried when I would leave every night and go, well, what was I thinking? You know,
what's that like to be committed to a role and a movie or a television show that you realize early on it's not for you?
You know, luckily I haven't done a whole lot of that. I mean, that one I just named was one of them. But luckily, there haven't been a lot. In the beginning of my film career, there were some that I simply had to do because I had two kids and I had to earn a living. And so you sort of have to bite that bullet. But mostly I was lucky that things, not a lot of scripts really would come to me, even after I had won awards and things. Like I thought, you know, you would land in some golden land where all of these wonderful screenplays just came at you and you just, you know, sat around and ate bonbons and tried to decide which one to do. And that never happened.
Why didn't that happen?
Well, I just don't think it does happen. It probably happens to Meryl.
Do you think she deserves
and,
it?
And rightfully so, Meryl, and rightfully so. Why shouldn't that happen
right.
to you? I didn't really mean that, but only sort of. I can say that glibly, but the truth is that one script would come to me every year, and that's all you need is one. because I would not have wanted to do more than that anyway, because it was hard to go away from my kids.
You mean one good one?
One really good one, script okay. would come, and it would be, you know, Absence of Malice, and it would be Places in the Heart, and it would be Soap Dish, and it would be Steel Magnolias, and that would just be that one script. So I'll take it. I'm not complaining about anything. I didn't need all those other scripts. You can have them, babe. They're yours, honey.
I was reading something that Colleen Dewhurst said about scripts and plays that she would get, and she said, "You just end up wanting to work. It becomes
yeah.
what's the least for her, the least bad role. I mean, for an amazing yeah. Yeah. actor like she
yeah.
was,
oh,
and then
was.
People. She said people would say, 'How in the hell did she choose that?'" And she'd say, "It was the least worst of the things that I got."
Yeah, that does happen. And then certainly as my, you know, long career has had many, you know, various and sundry ups and downs. And certainly that there were those times. And just, I'll just do that. Then, you know, some little, you take a risk. Like on a show when I had no intention of really going back and doing a television series. And then this thing came at me and I thought, well, you know, just take a chance. I don't really want to, but I need to make a living. And then it turned out to be Brothers and Sisters.
Yeah, and, I remember that. Yeah.
But it didn't happen like that because it had to evolve. It evolved into that. At the beginning, the first few shows, it sort of wasn't, and they were fumbling with, "Where's the show? We don't know really what the show is." And then they looked at all of us and said, "Oh, well, maybe this is the show." And it started to take its own form. And, you know, actually, in Brothers and Sisters, by then, they were letting me participate in that. And since they didn't know what it was like to be an older woman with grown children, and I happen to have been an older woman with grown children, they let me, you know, write Nora. So then she became, you know, just this, you know, character that was, I was glad to play, not because I had written her, but because she was about things that I was concerned with as an older person. And also because I had, at the time, my youngest son was just going off to college and trying to figure out his sexuality. He did not want to be any different than his brothers. Mm-hmm. And he was different than his brothers. And on the show, I have wonderful Matthew Reese playing my wonderful gay son. So it just fit together with my life again, in a way.
What does an actor do when it's clear that the people running the show and writing the show don't know what the show is?
Well, lots of times that happens. But luckily, they didn't know, but they knew they didn't know. And so they were looking, let's find it. And they were willing to, you know, change as it presented itself.
Right.
And that's rare, I think.
Because you've been on shows where, or
well, they
film
weren't willing
sets.
To do that on The Flying Nun. Put it that way. I mean, let me just say this: for the third year of The Flying Nun, I was pregnant. You didn't see that written in the show.
No, that's right. But I mean, I think you say in the memoir that The Flying Nun had like no reason for being except a nun who flew, and that was about it.
That was it.
Which is just...
That was it.
Blows my mind.
There was no story ever. 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 Except one story was about the pelican Irving that fell in love with the nun, and I had to do a whole show with a pelican, which was actually better than some of the other people I'd worked with. Which is totally not true. They were always just really lovely actors on The Nun. But there was, I mean, I had to do a scene with the pelican telling him I just wasn't ready to settle down yet. And people wondered why I was so frustrated.
That you have that picture, one of the photos in the memoir about all the nuns gathered around looking at this pelican like he's spouting words of wisdom or something.
I know.
But why did we love that show? Why did we, the audience, love that show?
It beats the hell out of me.
Would you talk about how the role of Norma Rae came to you, where you were in your life, and was that one of those scripts where there'd been a dry spell, you were waiting for the script to come? What happened?
Well, let's see. How do I even back into this? I had really fought like crazy and done, or been invited into the room, finally, to audition for a wonderful miniseries called Sybil. And, you know, no one wanted me in the room. No one, you know, just like, who let this girl in here? But the casting director had invited me into another audition room with the same kind of attitude with those people, and I had sort of convinced them otherwise. And so she invited me in here with Sybil. And I also worked really hard doing the work then that I knew how to do. I also knew how to audition, which was an important ingredient in it all. And I did get to do Sybil, as you know. Then, right around this time, as Sybil was coming out, I then was invited to do, I was called, and it was the first film that I was asked to do, but it was a really rotten script. I mean, really rotten. But the person who was starring in it wanted to call and talk to me, and that was Burt Reynolds, and it was Smokey and the Bandit.
We're going to talk about that a little later.
I did Smokey and the Bandit, and after that, there was just nothing happening. There were no films. I was doing, you know, the girl roles in some of Burt's movies, but I was trying to make a living, trying to hang on. I couldn't even find films to fight for, to you know, go to the line for. There was nothing, and I was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, on a film with Burt called Hooper, where, you know, mostly I had a few scenes, but I would always stay around to help take care of Burt, you know, help do the cooking and do the cleaning and go to the market, and, you know, I was kind of that. And I received a call that Marty Ritt, who was then and will always be considered one of the great directors, certainly one of the great voices in film, but certainly always considered one of the premier acting directors. So Marty Ritt wanted to meet with me. It's like I didn't have to beg him to let me in the door. And I was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, but they didn't need me. All I was trying to figure out what to cook for Burt's dinner the following night. So I just said to him, I'm going home. I've got to do this. I've got to go in this meeting. And I flew home the next day, but I hadn't read the script, because in those days, this was in 1978 or 9 or something, and they didn't have email, you know, they couldn't. There was no way to get me the script. It was waiting for me at home, but my mother, my backup generator, really the reason I wrote the book, was to find her. And she was taking care of my boys, and she said, I've got the script. We can do this, Sal. We can do it. You run upstairs, and we're going to get dressed. And I didn't know what to wear because I hadn't read the script. Who's the character? I'm saying, what? Tell me something about it. And she's, like, going on and on about whether she really wanted to see the movie, you know. And I'm going, Mother, I don't care whether it's a movie you want to see. I just need to know what it's about. What's the character? You know, I just went in beige. I just dressed head-to-toe beige. Tried to just be a blank slate so he could, like, put anything on me he needed to see, because I didn't know what Marty Ritt really wanted from me. So I went in to meet Marty, and he asked me, had I read the script? And I said, no. And I thought about lying, but I thought that wouldn't be good, so I said the truth. And he said, I want you to read it right away. I think you'll like it. We have offered this film to 5 other actresses, but they all turned it down. So I said, great, great. And he said, the studio doesn't want you. You're not a name to them, and they really don't want you. But Marty said, I want you. Things work out the way they're supposed to work out. The other actresses would have been very good, but this is yours. And I just didn't know what to say. He said, I want you to read the script and then let me know what you feel. I said, I don't need to read the script. I want this. He said, well, nonetheless, read it and talk to me. I read it, of course, that night with both of my little boys on either side of me sleeping, and my hands were shaking. And of course, I called him and said, I want to do this. He said, I will fight with them, and I will win. That's what Marty said. And I flew back to Tuscaloosa, and 2 days later, the phone rang as I was probably cooking dinner. And it was Marty saying, the role is yours, Sal.
Would you read the excerpt of what happens when you get on the set with Marty?
Sure. When we were about 3 weeks into our 9-week shoot, moving along so swiftly we tried to slow down for fear the studio wouldn't take us seriously, Marty knocked on the door of my motorhome, opened it, and stepped inside without waiting to hear my response. I sat frozen on the sofa, my needlework in midair as he plopped down on the swivel chair across from me. Because he'd never been in my camper before, I worried that I'd done something wrong, which is no big surprise. But when he acted as though he'd just wandered in, like he had nothing else to do, I suddenly felt shy. What would I say to him? We'd been together socially several times when Adele, his wife, had gatherings in their bungalow next to mine, small dinner parties that usually included other members of the cast and crew. Once it had even been only the three of us. But Marty and I had never been alone together. As he looked out the window, watching the smattering of crew weaving around the pine trees, he began talking about the spinning room and the dinosaur-like machines that several of us had learned to operate. He laughingly told me that one of the actors had to walk outside because the old wooden floor's swaying vibrations had made them seasick, and asked me why I hadn't needed a break. I told him I was too busy to think about it, and he refused to tell me which actor it was, and we sat in an easy silence. Then he stood, looking at his watch, and with a time to mosey back to the set attitude, stepped down into the well of the door and grabbed hold of the handle. He paused for a moment, then turning to look at me, he said, I want you to know, Sal, you're first rate. Just wanted to tell you. With that, he left the trailer, closing the door behind him. No amount of applause, praise, or accolades that I might receive in my lifetime will ever mean more to me than those few words from Marty Ritt.
Thank you. You're listening to Talking Volumes at the Fitzgerald Theater with writer and actor Sally Field. Her new memoir is called In Pieces. Part of the, I guess, mystery you had to solve or knowledge you had to come to terms with was why, when this relationship with your stepfather was occurring, when he was sexually abusing you, your mother wasn't really present or understanding it or seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something? I feel like there were conversations that you had with your mother that you chronicle here that edged into that,
mm-hmm.
but is that something you ever felt that you could hash out with her?
Well, I think what I ultimately saw, and I tried from the very beginning to paint the picture of this handed down history
mm-hmm.
from my great-grandmother to my grandmother to my mother to me. And that's part of it, of these women that never really speak of the atrocities that go on in their lives because they just carry on. They just carry on. And certainly she was part of that. And I felt that was part of my existence as well. Mm-hmm. There were questions you didn't ask because you didn't want to know the answer, and you just carried on. And there were times in my life when I tried to talk to both my mother and my younger sister because I needed people to know. I needed them, not people, them. There was a malignancy in our relationship, and that was it. And I needed them to know what had happened and how I still couldn't resolve it in my life. But it was so hard for me to speak about. You know, people talk about, why couldn't you speak up? It's so incredibly hard to speak about. I was so frightened of it and ashamed and horrified, and I couldn't say the words. And I felt in my own haze, it was one time during the nun, I felt I had said enough. Haven't I said enough that you would, I painted the picture, can't you see it? And they didn't quite see it, and they reacted to something else. That's how people do. They talk around each other. And I thought for sure I said that. And then, no, my sisters thought I had said something else. So it never got said.
You do have that moment. I think you're together. You go to bed kind of angry with each other because this has been alluded to. But doesn't she come to you the next morning?
No, it is the end of the book. It's the conversation I waited to have my whole life. She's like a little hairless bird, you know, a little baby hairless bird with big eyes and, you know, dying. And how it all, again, my life was happening all at the same time, because I had just, you know, worked really hard, again, put myself on the line to make sure I got the role of Mary Todd. And this was all happening literally at the same time. The conversation I had with my mother, it was, you know, I was fixing dinner, and she, and I don't, I part of me doesn't want to tell all of it, because then why read the book? And
oh, there's so much
and
more.
It's a mystery. You won't know whether I lived or died at the end, you know? But she was heroic. First she wasn't. At first she was everything you would think. But I put her to bed because I thought she was going to drop dead right then, and then what would I do? And the next morning I didn't hear her, and I thought, well, that's it, Sally. You know, you killed her. and I knocked on her door. She was living with me, and she was heroic, like you can't believe. But she always was, and I say it in there. I say it in the book. She was my perfectly imperfect mother, and I would not have wanted another. It didn't matter about anything else. That's the end of the book. So, good night, folks. Oh.
Don't leave yet. I don't want to miss asking you about Burt Reynolds.
Why?
Oh, because you wrote some loving things and some very candid things about Burt Reynolds. And you say that when you were with him, you became a kind of shadowy version of yourself. Now, you alluded to this earlier, where on the set of this movie, basically you were in caretaker mm-hmm. role. But it wasn't like that at the very beginning of the relationship, was it?
Yeah.
Even from the beginning.
It, you know, I Bert was a really a complicated, flawed human, charismatic and had so many good things, and was a human, and people don't, I think, want to acknowledge that. I think we were the perfect match of flaws. He was like a preformed rut in my road. I was like ordained. I mean, it was going to happen that way, because he fit perfectly into a system that was already working. It was already my childhood system. I couldn't see any difference between what I had been through in my life and what this was. So I had been taught loving someone from because of the complications of my childhood, when you what love really is you feel love, but you also feel danger. They have to go together. Otherwise, it's not love, because that's what I was taught. They say that once fired together is wired together. So as a child, when I was with my stepfather, I was terrified, but I felt loved. So that must be love. So it must go like this. But also, I learned to disappear. I learned to be loved by my stepfather. I had to disappear. The worth of me, the best of me, went out the window and had to stay out the window. And so naturally, that was my system of understanding how to be loved. I would just simply, okay, this must be love. I also feel kind of frightened, and I think I'll just disappear. And yet, I would constantly write in my journals, and these are the things I had to look at. I could see myself having a debate with myself, saying, run, this isn't right, this isn't where you need to be. You know, you need to run, you feel trapped. I felt like there were old traps, and I couldn't see my way out of it. I couldn't even articulate it. I would say on the page, run, 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 you need to run, like danger. And then the other part of me would talk to that person and say, yes, but he needs me, and he's having a hard time, and he's having some health issues, and I have to come and help him. And clearly, I was trying to take it, whatever damage there was in Bert, I was seeing was really in me. And that's not to say, you know, that he too was not complicated and seeing through his childhood mechanisms and patterns. So there were two people that I don't think we really even saw each other, because we were so looking in our rearview mirror of what we knew to be behavior. And I say in the book many times, I mean, first of all, I don't make a conclusion about it. I just try to say what I felt and the things that happened. And it was a time when I was really starting to bubble up out of my own system. I was gonna break out of this system or die trying. So maybe Bert, in that way, was good for me. When he finally challenged Norma Rae, basically, that he threw the script at me and said he thought it was a piece of, well, crap, I'm just going to say it so it doesn't have to be cut from the radio, but that's not what he said, and accused me of just wanting to play a whore, and I didn't stick up for myself. I stuck up for her. I stuck up for the character, and it was a really important time between us, because it was the time I started to stand up. But it wasn't about me I was standing up for. I was standing up for something I loved more than me, the craft. He would not take my acting away from me. Take whatever you like. Take my air. Here, want some air? I have some. How about this oxygen out of my lungs? But don't you dare take acting away from me, or I'm out the door. And that was kind of the beginning. But he was, it was good, and it was a lot of lovely, loving things. But I say many times, if I could have been different, would he not have perhaps been different? But I couldn't have been different. I was locked in a childhood pattern that I try to paint very clearly. I mean, I think our task as human beings, as grown-ups, is all of us, whether we came from a complicated, traumatic childhood or just from a great childhood. We all have these childhood patterns that will hold us back if we can't unweave them as adults and let a lot of them go and move into new territory.
Sally Field, Talking Volumes at the Fitzgerald Theater. Our Talking Volumes season finale coming up on November 14th. It is sold out with Alexander McCall Smith, but you will hear it at 9 a.m. after the show.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.